always beaten, always hated. If I can't do it through pacifism, if I can't show you through the displaying of intelligence, then I will do it with a bullet. Murder is not weak and slow-witted. Murder is gutsy and daring.
Just minutes after firing two fatal shots at the Virginia Tech dormitory on Monday, Cho Sung-hui returned to his own dorm room and made the final preparations to mail what appears to be a video confession.
Or consider Sung-hee Cho, who committed one of the worst mass shootings in American history when he went on a shooting spree at Virginia Tech University in 2007, killing 32 people. Cho was a socially isolated, troubled young man with a history of mental health problems who had clearly bought into a cultural narrative that says the way to reclaim manhood is through projecting an image of menace and toughness, instilling fear in others, and using violence. Before he committed the Virginia Tech massacre, he wrote, produced, and starred in his own video, demonstrating how thoroughly he'd bought into this Hollywood script. Cho isn't the only mass murderer whose violent actions enabled him to rewrite the script of his life in order to place himself back in the manly starring role.
All you hear is like firecrackers, and then I looked out the window and there's a kid with a trench coat and a shotgun throwing pipe bombs in the parking lot.
The Columbine killers Eric Harris and Dylan Klebold left behind written diaries that provide insight into how their murder of 12 classmates and a teacher was part of a conscious strategy to settle scores. In his journal, Klebold writes that he and Harris will take revenge on society. And toward the end of his own journal, Harris writes, "Everyone is always making fun of me because of how I look, how f***ing weak I am, and well, I will get you all back. I hate people, and they better f***ing fear me if they know what's good for them."
The shooter was 36-year-old Andrew Engeldinger, an employee of the small company who had recently lost his job.
And this isn't just about young men. Again and again, we've seen the same thing with older men who commit mass shootings.
A troubled ex-husband is under arrest in a Southern California hair salon shooting that left eight people dead.
In case after case, these men have faced grief, bitter disappointment, and feelings of failure.
The shooter, Richard Farley, was obsessed with a female colleague. He had also been laid off.
They are either chronically unemployed, have been left by their wives or girlfriends, been fired from their jobs, or have suffered some other kind of serious blow to their self-worth as men. Nothing can excuse the pathetic and cowardly way men like these use violence and destroy the lives of innocent people to make some kind of a statement. But we're kidding ourselves if we think these killings will stop unless and until we can identify and transform the larger cultural belief systems that underlie them.
From the mass shooting in Tucson aimed at former Congresswoman Gabrielle Giffords to the Colorado movie theater massacre, killers in many recent mass killings suffered mental illness.
Of course, there's no question that mental illness has played a role in a lot of rampage killings and mass shootings. But what never seems to get discussed is why it is that somewhere around 98% of school shootings and rampage killings have been committed by men, even though there are plenty of young women who suffer from mental illness as well. What this tells us is that violence can't be reduced to mental illness on its own, especially since the vast majority of mentally ill people are not violent at all. The bottom line is that even men who are mentally ill live and operate within a culture that has normalized violent masculinity and defined manhood in exceedingly narrow ways.
It's been widely reported school shooter Adam Lanza suffered some kind of personality disorder.
The Sandy Hook Elementary school shooter Adam Lanza may have been mentally ill, but he played out a familiar script.
He was bullied severely, brutally bullied, when he was in elementary school at Sandy Hook.
By all accounts, he was a socially awkward boy who didn't fit in and appears to have been mercilessly bullied.
That's a clip of the video game Call of Duty. It's also the game that Adam Lanza used to play.
He developed a revenge fantasy, secured firearms, and then killed his own mother before carrying out one of the most brutal and ruthless mass killings in American history. And in his own delusional and twisted way, he would recapture the sense of respect that seemed to have eluded him his whole life. The children of Newtown, like so many other innocent victims of men's violence, became theatrical props in the performance of an aggrieved, angry, and likely self-hating young man who absorbed all the wrong lessons about what it means to be a tough, strong man from the world around him. Just take a look at the ad campaign the Bushmaster Firearms Company ran prior to the Newtown massacre for the very AR-15-style semi-automatic rifle Lanza used during his killing spree. What all of this amounts to is that our violence problem seems to be a lot less about lone wolves and monsters who fail to conform to society's norms than it is about too many men, in a sense, over-conforming to our norms and ideals of manhood out of fear of not being seen as men. When we talk about men's violence and dominant ideals of violent masculinity, there's a temptation to frame things in terms of the damage men do to others. but we need to look also at the devastating harm these norms do to men themselves. This is certainly true of gun violence. Every year in this country, over 30,000 people are killed by guns, something like 85 per day. The vast majority of these victims are men, approximately 86%. But while we're used to thinking about gun violence in terms of mass shootings and urban crime, we really don't talk a lot about how most gun deaths are the result of men and boys shooting themselves. Suicide, which is really violence turned inward, accounts for close to two-thirds of all gun deaths. The vast majority of people who kill themselves with a gun are men, and white men comprise over 80% of these firearm suicides. Violence doesn't just leave physical scars. It also leaves emotional scars. Look at the cost to African-American boys and young men of living in and around violence. Violence is the leading cause of death of African-American men between the ages of 15 and 30. But they also have much higher than average rates of depression, school dropout, mental health problems linked to perpetual stress, substance abuse. And just look at the terrible toll violence has taken on the psyches of men who serve in combat zones.
In the 5 years between 2006 and 2009, more than 1,100 members of the armed services took their own lives.
Something like half of U.S. service members who have done tours in Iraq and Afghanistan have signs of trauma, depression, flashbacks, alcohol and drug problems. In her landmark study, Trauma and Recovery, Judith Herman draws a powerful connection between the experience of male combat veterans and women who are the victims of domestic and sexual violence. The sources of the violence and their context might vary, but the unifying theme is that human beings, young and old, women and men, suffer when their physical and sexual boundaries are violated. But in the case of men, this pain gets compounded by a cultural belief system that equates manhood with invulnerability and ridicules and shames men who admit to being in emotional pain. In his classic work, I Don't Want to Talk About It, the therapist Terry Real identifies the widespread phenomenon of what he calls covert depression, a condition that roughly three-quarters of American men suffer in silence out of fear of seeming like less than a real man. For many of these men, childhood trauma and other experiences of violence play a role in this depression, which then can affect not only their ability to take care of themselves physically and emotionally, but also hinder their ability to sustain healthy relationships in adult life. Despite predictable arguments that equate trying to understand or prevent violence with weakness, the bottom line is that we have to have the strength to ask these kind of questions if we want to move beyond the never-ending cycle of violence. And that starts with examining the dominant stories we tell ourselves as a culture about manhood and violence and demanding more honest and accurate representations of the personal and societal consequences of violent masculinity. War movies like Saving Private Ryan showed not only the awe-inspiring courage of the men who stormed the beaches in Normandy and fought totalitarianism during World War II. The film also captured the panic, anxiety, and sheer terror of the young men who experienced that war.
There's too many locks. There's too many. I can't do it.
I do.
I can't get it off. I'm sorry, okay? You understand? I'm sorry.
More recently, The Hurt Locker explored another devastating effect of battlefield trauma. Showing how the intensity and violence of war make it difficult for many veterans to adjust back to civilian life. And we saw the same kind of honest and tragic portrayal of dominant masculinity in the film The Wrestler, starring Mickey Rourke as an over-the-hill professional wrestler whose body was ravaged by physical injury and who was so emotionally damaged by violence that he couldn't imagine life outside the glamour of the arena. Intensely realistic shows like HBO's The Wire have refused to glamorize urban street life and violent crime, directly confronting the costs young men of color too often pay for their investment in the idea that respect comes only at the business end of a Glock. And we've seen emotionally complex shows like The Sopranos, which centered on brutal mob boss Tony Soprano, a ruthless killer who intimidated everyone around him, but also portrayed him as a deeply troubled man who had recurring panic attacks and who had to battle his own anxiety and self-doubt when he turned to a woman therapist for help.
Whatever happened to Gary Cooper, the strong, silent type? That was an American. He wasn't in touch with his feelings. He just did what he had to do. See, what they didn't know is once they got Gary Cooper in touch with his feelings, that they wouldn't be able to shut him up. And then it's dysfunction this, and dysfunction that, and dysfunction...
And then there's Good Will Hunting, which catapulted Matt Damon to fame, with Damon playing the role of an intellectually gifted working-class tough guy who relieves the trauma of his abusive childhood by hardening himself to the world and fighting anyone who challenges him. With the support of a woman who loves him and a therapist he comes to trust, finds the courage to battle through his defenses, look inside himself, and let go of his bottled-up rage. After the Newtown Massacre, there was a lot of tough guy talk about how the cure for our violence problem is yet more violence.
The only thing that stops a bad guy with a gun is a good guy with a gun.
But there were other men who spoke in the wake of Newtown as well. Men like Neil Heslin, whose 6-year-old son, Jesse, was among the 20 children gunned down that tragic day.
He was my son, he was my buddy, he was my best friend.
What was so important about his testimony was that he went beyond expressing grief for his son and directly challenged the culture of violence. Too often we define masculine strength by who can blow away the most people, who can flex the most muscle, who can impose their will and inflict the most damage. But this cheapens the real definition of strength and toughness. We respect the toughness of firefighters who rush into burning buildings when others are rushing out, police officers and other first responders who put their lives on the line, not because they're out to prove something, but because they steel themselves in the face of danger and face down their fears in service to others. For the same reason, we should respect the toughness and strength of men who challenge the myth that being a real man requires putting up a false front, disrespecting others, and engaging in violent and self-destructive behavior. Strength is about adapting to change, not about retreating from it and lashing back with violence out of fear. And it's high time we had a definition of manhood capable of meeting that challenge.
While the program helped to diagnose the root causes of America's increasing levels of hypermasculinity, bullying, and gun violence, as well as the correlation between violence and manhood. But it seems that changing this culture, which is rooted so deeply in grotesque models of violence, is easier said than done. That's it for this week. Do join us next week here on Aperture. Until another Aperture, it's goodbye.
Follow us on social media to stay up to date on the latest global developments. You can keep in touch with us by following us on Twitter at twitter.com/ParsTodayEN. You can also follow IRIB English Radio on Instagram via instagram.com/ParsTodayEnglish.
In the limelight.
At Falono Society for Deaf Children in Gaza City conducted a survey of 102 people shortly after a ceasefire brought an end to Israeli regime's bombardments in May. More than 84% of those surveyed had a disability. More than 38% of respondents replied that their homes were slightly damaged. Another 8% stated that the damage to their homes was severe. Almost 19% replied that their movements were curtailed during the attack and they could not fulfill their basic needs as a result. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by Rovaida Omer Ryder. This article is titled Zionist Regime Puts Gaza's Deaf People in Extreme Danger. Stay tuned for more. Mahmoud Abu Namous has just become a father for the first time. His daughter was born in September following an extremely stressful pregnancy. The worst stress was during the 11 days when the Zionist regime carried out a major attack against Gaza in May. Mahmoud is deaf. His wife, Fatima Zahir, had to remind him regularly that he should stay away from windows in their Gaza City home during those dangerous days. He had to confine himself within those parts of their home where he would be less vulnerable as explosions occurred. Mahmoud shared Fatima's fear each time she heard a blast. He said, "I could sense it from her facial expressions." The attack brought back painful memories. Mahmoud and his family were uprooted from their home during a previous Zionist offensive in the summer of 2014. Mahmoud was preparing for his high school exams at that time. He recalls being so frustrated and tired that his mother's warning to leave their home immediately barely registered with him. The family's home was destroyed after they evacuated. Lacking adequate support, some deaf people went to considerable lengths to be properly informed about what was happening in May of this year. TV stations generally did not show sign language interpreters on a screen during news programs. Mahmoud tried to fill the gap by gathering what information he could find and making sign language videos of his own. He posted those videos on Instagram so that other deaf people in Gaza could watch them. Both Saida Miqdad and her husband, Zedine, are deaf. During the May attack, Saida said, "I felt that I was in terrible danger whenever the house shook, but I did not know where the bombs were landing." Saida lives in Gaza City, but has family in Khan Yunis area of southern Gaza. She said, "They understand sign language, so I could communicate with them by video during the attack. But the connection was unreliable because of electricity cuts and because we only had internet access some of the time." Heba Abu Jazar is a deaf community activist living in Rafah, near Gaza's border with Egypt. She recalled how members of her family were constantly telling us to be careful during the May attack. She said, "When there was shelling near my house, we were able to escape to my uncle's place because it was safer. I was very afraid because I could not hear what was happening." In the early stages of the attack, she and her sisters viewed photos and videos of atrocities on the internet. She said, "That made us feel even more afraid and anxious, so we decided to stay away from the news. It was only a temporary solution, but it gave us a bit more courage to keep going." The Asfaluna Society for Deaf Children in Gaza City conducted a survey of 102 people shortly after a ceasefire brought an end to the Zionist regime's bombardment in May. More than 84% of those surveyed had a disability. More than 38% of respondents replied that their homes were slightly damaged. Another 8% stated that the damage to their homes was severe. Almost 19% replied that their movements were curtailed during the attack and they could not fulfill their basic needs as a result. Umayya Hels, a sign language teacher, spent most of the 11 days during which Gaza was attacked to provide deaf people with emotional support. Deaf people, she explained, constantly feel that they are marginalized by society. That sense of marginalization exacerbated the fears of many deaf people in May. Most of the deaf people in Gaza are unemployed, Health added. There are many jobs they could do, but because they are deaf, they are rarely accepted. This is not good. It makes them feel frustrated and lose hope. An additional problem is that deaf people have in many cases not received counseling since the attack. Ellis said psychologists and social workers must learn sign language so that they can run support sessions for people with hearing disabilities. Nagla Mahmoud is a mother of six children living in Khan Yunus. As Nagla is deaf, she relied on her 11-year-old daughter Shams to explain in sign language what was happening during the May offensive. Nagla said, "It was very difficult because my children were screaming from the sounds of the missiles. I tried to stay beside them all the time, to hug and hold them. I often sat crying in fear. But my husband always reassured me that the attack would end and we would survive."
Wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
Saudi Arabia and its ally, the United Arab Emirates, have been defying international calls for an end to their disastrous war in Yemen. The destructive military campaign that's triggered the world's worst humanitarian crisis has been ongoing since March 2015. Tens of thousands of people, most of them civilians, have been killed in airstrikes or by deadly diseases or hunger. Millions have been displaced. Yemen's economy is in tatters, and international aid can hardly make its way to those in severe need because of a Saudi blockade. Despite untold human suffering, Saudis and Emiratis keep pounding Yemen in a war that has achieved none of its stated goals. And the aggressors are absolutely intolerant of any form of criticism of what they are doing in Yemen. That was on full display this week as criticism of the devastating war by a Lebanese minister infuriated the kingdom and its allies, triggering angry reactions from them. Saudi Arabia and most members of the Saudi-led Persian Gulf Cooperation Council, namely the UAE, Bahrain, and Kuwait, summoned Lebanese ambassadors to their capitals. This after Lebanese Information Minister George Kordai called for an end to the futile military campaign against Yemen. The Saudi Foreign Ministry said in a statement that it handed the ambassador a memorandum protesting against the minister's, quote, offensive remarks.
They know they're in the wrong. They feel guilty. And they also feel a sense of impunity. They feel that no one should criticize them because they've got lots of money and other people don't. So, it's a very sensitive subject for them. What they're doing in Yemen is... If any other country had done it, they would have been condemned much more fiercely and much sooner by the other countries in the region and the world. But the Saudis think that they have a lock on the Arab world and the Islamic world and much of the Western world, so they really don't understand criticism.
The Lebanese information minister said in the interview that the Saudi-led forces are pounding homes, villages, funerals, and weddings. Kordai also said that he believes that the popular Ansar Allah forces are defending themselves against an external aggression. The Lebanese information minister is now finding himself at the center of a political storm for speaking his mind. This is because Lebanon has been trying to improve ties with Persian Gulf Arab states. Prime Minister Najib Mikati seems to be in damage control mode now. He said the interview was recorded before his cabinet was formed and was a personal opinion rather than official policy. The information minister, who is under pressure for his remarks against the devastating war in Yemen, says he stated his position with love as a human who feels Arab suffering. The humanitarian situation in Yemen is apocalyptic. The unbearable suffering of civilians in Yemen has been ongoing for several years. But no measure has been taken against the war, which has also been militarily backed by Western allies of Saudi Arabia. The war in Yemen had been planned to quickly achieve its goals, like reinstating former President Abd Rabbu Mansour Hadi, who is a Saudi ally. But it has proved to be an embarrassing failure. Despite this, the invaders remain defiant and are not changing course. This has taken a heavy toll on Yemen's infrastructure and civilian population. Faced with international inaction, the Yemenis have been left with no other option than retaliatory missile and drone attacks against Saudi targets.
Iran's capital, Tehran, hosted a meeting on its neighboring country, Afghanistan. The top diplomats of Uzbekistan, Tajikistan, Turkmenistan, and Pakistan have attended the gathering in person, while the Chinese and Russian foreign ministers were present online. The UN chief also sent a message to the summit online.
We need to keep engaging to help move things in the right direction. Force Afghans and the region also need a country that is secure, not one that is a haven for terrorism or a center for drug trafficking. This is vital to peace and stability in the region and around the world. Excellencies, these are all issues on which the region has a shared interest and on which all of us must speak with one voice. We can only achieve more stability with a united approach. Together, let us act with determination and without delay to help the people of Afghanistan and to secure a better future for all.
The Wednesday conference took place a week after the third meeting of the Moscow format consultations on Afghanistan was held in the Russian capital. The Tehran meeting is aimed at stepping up collaborations between Afghanistan's neighboring countries and creating lasting peace there. Iran has always strongly advised against the interference of foreigners in Afghanistan's affairs and respected the country's independence and territorial integrity. It has also urged the formation of an inclusive government in the country.
In Afghanistan, we are facing a situation that in order to reach an acceptable point for all Afghans, we still have a long way ahead of us.
Amir Abdullahian said this is a joint press conference with the visiting Pakistani counterpart, Shah Mahmood Qureshi, in Tehran. He added that Iran was pursuing contacts with all neighbors to Afghanistan to make sure the utmost use of capacities was achieved at its border crossings for trade and humanitarian aid delivery. The United States is a major factor in the current mess in Afghanistan. The U.S. military led the invasion of Afghanistan in 2001 in what it proclaimed was a war on terror, meant to eradicate the Taliban. 20 years on, in mid-August this year, the Afghan government and military collapsed in the face of the Taliban's swift advances on the ground, which many attribute to a hasty withdrawal of U.S.-led occupation forces from the country. The UN World Food Program says 3.2 million children under 5 are close to acute malnutrition. Afghanistan is now on the brink of bankruptcy, The U.S. has frozen $10 billion of the country's assets in a bid to bring poor and war-weary Afghans to their knees. The resurgence of the Daesh terrorist group on the back of the U.S. exit has created fresh security challenges for the Taliban-ruled country. It's believed that the presence of Daesh terrorists in Afghanistan perfectly serves the interests of Americans.
Well, yeah, Islamic State has been used by the U.S., as has Al-Qaeda inside Syria. So they use these proxies to destroy the stability of countries.
Afghanistan lies at the crossroads of South and Central Asia. It has been rocked by a series of terrorist attacks in recent weeks, which killed scores of people, most of them were Shia worshippers. There are reports that in the months before the U.S.-led coalition forces left the country, thousands of terrorists made their way to Afghanistan from Central Asia, North Caucasus, Pakistan, and China's Xinjiang region. Most of them were recruited by Daesh.
Every indication is that the U.S. will try, which is why this inclusive government is needed to resist such abilities to drive a wedge in society.
These foreign terrorists slipped into the country under the nose of U.S. and NATO forces. The American presence in the war-ravaged country, often described as the graveyard of empires, not only failed to wipe out the threat of terrorism, but further fanned its flames.
It all started in November 2017 when Saudi forces detained dozens of royals and business people and imprisoned them inside the Ritz-Carlton Hotel in Riyadh under the pretext of an anti-corruption drive ordered by the newly appointed Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman, also referred to as MBS. He has gone to great lengths to consolidate power and eliminate potential rivals ever since. On March 6, 2020, Mohammed bin Nayef, Saudi Arabia's former crown prince, was detained on the charge of treason. Saad al-Jabri, a former Saudi spy master and bin Nayef's longtime aide, is the latest high-profile figure caught in the heated rivalry. Jabri alleged in a lawsuit last year that MBS sent a, quote, target squad to assassinate him in Canada, where he lives in exile. He also said the crown prince detained his two children to pressure him to go back to Saudi Arabia.
A psychopath with no empathy, doesn't feel emotion, never learned from his experience. And we have witnessed atrocities and crimes committed by this killer. And the warning I received, don't be in a proximity of any Saudi mission in Canada. Don't go to the consulate, don't go to the embassy. Said why? Said they dismembered the guy, they killed him. You are on the top of the list.
Two lawsuits filed by Saudi state-run companies are accusing Jabri of embezzlement. The firms are part of a network providing cover for clandestine operations with the U.S. Court documents show Jabri intends to make revelations that include matters related to, quote, U.S. national security activities, raising concerns inside Washington and prompting the U.S. to consider a rare judicial intervention.
Well, I would say that Mohammed bin Salman, the supposed Saudi crown prince, never really goes to school and learns any kind of lesson whatsoever. He got away with murdering Khashoggi in Turkey, and the Americans huffed and puffed, and the intelligence services said that he was most likely involved, that the Saudis were definitely involved, and nothing was done about it.
Jamal Khashoggi was a Saudi dissident journalist who was killed and dismembered at the kingdom's embassy in Istanbul in October 2018. From Yemen to Istanbul, Saudi Arabia has left a trail of bodies behind. But that's not to say it doesn't target its people within the confine of its borders. As MBS kicked off his campaign of crackdown on dissent, he announced a series of social reforms, including the so-called women's rights reforms, lifting bans on driving and travel restrictions. Amid all the fanfare, however, the kingdom launched a tougher crackdown on women's rights activists, raising questions about Riyadh's intentions of announcing the reforms in the first place. In the meantime, Al-Jabri alleged in the interview that MBS had even mentioned his intention of assassinating Saudi Arabia's former King Abdullah, and that there is video evidence proving it.
That's what he said, whether he's just bragging or but he said that, and we took it seriously.
Does this video recording still exist?
Yes. I know where it is now. I know there are two copies of that. I know where they are.
Well, the Saudi Crown Prince, Mohammed bin Salman, is desperately afraid of Saad al-Jabri. Al-Jabri was in the Interior Ministry. He was the Interior Minister's right-hand man. And he knows where the bodies are buried and where the money went. He has been has stated, to my knowledge, that the king and his son Mohammed bin Salman have been dipping into the Saudi government funds more than what is being appropriated for them, which astonishingly is $800 million per month.
U.S. President Joe Biden vowed earlier this year to press Saudi Arabia over its rights records, but decided not to penalize the kingdom for assassinating Khashoggi. If the violators of human rights aren't held accountable, doesn't that embolden them to think they can carry on and get away with murder in its most literal sense?
The International Islamic Unity Conference is held annually in Tehran. The conference brings together Shia and Sunni scholars and intellectuals from around the world. On Sunday, Iran's Islamic Revolution leader, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, addressed Iranian officials and foreign participants at the 35th International Islamic Unity Conference in Tehran. Ayatollah Khamenei emphasized the importance of unity. He stated that the reason for his repeated emphasis on this issue is the large divide that exists across faiths, with enemies attempting to increase it. Ayatollah Khamenei warned that the U.S. tries to sow discord among Muslims by raising the issue of Sunni and Shia. Both Shia and Sunnis agree on most of the fundamental beliefs and practices of Islam. Their bitter divide goes back some 14 centuries. It began with disagreement about who should succeed the Prophet Muhammad as the leader of Islamic faith, but the two have coexisted despite the differences. Ayatollah Khamenei further said, "Unity among Muslims is a principal command by the Holy Quran and not a tactic dictated by circumstances." He added that a novel Islamic civilization can only be established when Shia and Sunni Muslims converge in a united front. In his speech, Ayatollah Khamenei also said that Palestine serves as the top criteria for unity in the Muslim world. Ayatollah Khamenei criticized certain regional states for normalizing relations with Israel, calling the approach sinful and wrong. Bahrain and the United Arab Emirates signed the U.S.-brokered Abraham Accords at the White House in 2020 to normalize ties with the occupying Israeli regime. Morocco and Sudan later signed normalization agreements with Israel as well. Daesh has maintained a foothold in eastern and northeastern Afghanistan following the United States' hasty withdrawal from the country, which led to the collapse of the Afghan government and the Taliban takeover in mid-August. Daesh has claimed responsibility for several attacks against the Taliban recently. It has also targeted Shias in Syria and Iraq in the past. Iran's leader, Ayatollah Khamenei, touched on the U.S. attempt to incite unrest among Islamic countries through its proxies. Ayatollah Khamenei blamed the U.S. for a recent wave of terrorist attacks by Daesh targeting Shia Muslim mosques in Afghanistan that killed scores of people. Ayatollah Khamenei said one method to prevent such incidents is for present Afghan leaders to visit Shia centers and mosques and urge Sunni Muslims to join interreligious congregations.
Yes, I mean, it's very clear that the U.S. has always been backing these mercenary terrorist networks such as the Daesh, and it serves their cause as long as the Muslim Ummah has disunity and there's this sedition and this hatred that is being bred inside the Islamic world. Then they can easily control the region, take over the resources, build their bases, and you know, secure their puppets that they have installed in place.
Ayatollah Khamenei urged Islamic countries to set aside their differences and stressed that unity among Muslims will create synergy and strengthen them in interacting with non-Islamic countries.
Is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily, round the clock, for listeners across the globe. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard by the internet, shortwave radio, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 41 meters, 7,300 kilohertz every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 49 meters, 6,040 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave, 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz. Every day from 1920 to 2020. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 MHz. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iransat or BAD 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is pastoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about our audio quality and other means. Thank you.
As-salamu alaykum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
Hame ba wujood ghudde saratani Israel mukhalifim.
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel.
Wajh mushtarak hame wahdat ummat islami.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
September 2nd, 2021. On the occasion of the National Government Week, President Raisi and the cabinet members met with Imam Khamenei in the Imam Khomeini Hosseiniya during the first days after the formation of the 30th administration.
The goal was to encourage the people to rise for justice so that that society will be a just society. Well, we are behind in these areas and we have to work a great deal. In my opinion, every resolution that you pass and every bill that you draft in the administration and every directive that you issue in your organization should have a section on justice. You should take care not to let your decrees and your methods damage justice and violate the rights of underprivileged classes. This caution should always exist. You should ensure this with a written addendum. Or you should prepare your draft in a way that justice will be ensured. Sometimes a managerial method and a common practice do harm. We have really seen these cases. Today too, there are some habits in our affairs that should be corrected. These habits exist in various areas, primarily in the area of justice and distributing the resources of the country.
دنیای اسلام یک نسخه امروز دارد و اون اتحاد.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
These resources should really be distributed in a fair manner. However, in the present time, this is not the case in some areas. Of course, when I say this, it does not mean that there is an ulterior motive in play. But for example, in the area of energy and oil, an official in the previous administration delivered a report to me recently showing that the hidden subsidies for oil in the year 1399 amounted to $63 billion. Well, who receives these subsidies? Who benefits more from the country's oil and petroleum resources? A significant and important number of the people do not benefit from this subsidy at all. However, officials have calculated that $63 billion, that is 1,500 billion tomans, are allocated to this subsidy, which is more than the budget for the year 1399. Well, this is only an example that I cited. Of course, I am not offering advice on oil. You should examine it on your own and see what you can do.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Ruba Shavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pereza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
About 4,000 high school students took to the streets of the Italian capital to stage a rally against the upcoming G20 summit of world leaders. Pupils from secondary schools called on the summit's participants to stop the injustices that, quote, have led the planet to the climate crisis and invest significantly in public education as a way to give them a future. The G20 summit will reportedly focus on climate change, health and the global economic recovery.
We already know for sure that the world leaders will not opt to invest in public health, social welfare, or in fixing the climate crisis. Quite the contrary, their resolutions will be taken in support of banks and large multinationals.
We are here because our school system is on its knees. Public education must be a priority. World leaders must understand it.
Also on Friday, charities Oxfam, Amnesty International and Emergency held a flash mob in Rome's city centre demanding world leaders to end global inequality of access to vaccines and coronavirus treatments. According to charities' representatives, billions of people around the world are denied access to COVID vaccine because big pharmas are actively blocking other manufacturers from producing much-needed doses and continue to prioritize selling vaccines to rich countries.
The situation is very serious because in low-income countries at the moment, less than 2% of the population have been fully vaccinated, while in high-income countries the average is more than 60%.
A large security operation will be enforced with a 10 square kilometer maximum security area in the Eur Quarter, the district surrounding the Congress Center where the G20 summit is taking place. The authorities are wary of the danger that anti-vax extremists and black blocs may pose if they infiltrate the protests. Airspace is closed over Rome and border controls have been enhanced in the attempt to keep away violent protesters.
The G20 summit kicks off on Saturday. Up to 6,000 police officers along with 500 soldiers will be deployed in the Italian capital as authorities fear violent demonstrations during the meeting. Max Civili, Rome.
European Commission President Ursula von der Leyen greeted Polish Prime Minister Mateusz Morawiecki at the beginning of a five-hour debate in the European Parliament. The niceties didn't last long.
Don't try to divert. That's the debate right now here about the rule of law and the primacy of European law. Don't try to run away and to escape that debate.
Morawiecki insists Poland's constitution has primacy over EU law, and this is infuriating the bloc's establishment. Amongst other things, EU authorities are worried the Polish government is trampling on fundamental rights, judicial independence and freedom of the press. Morawiecki insists hypocrisy is at play when rule of law is debated.
Some member states maintain tax havens. It means that in the EU, the richest member states are making even more money. How is this part of our EU values?
Criticism towards Morawiecki kept on coming, however.
For years, you have been infecting the mind of Polish people with lies and manipulation about European rules and regulations.
The Polish Prime Minister raised a myriad of issues, ranging from the EU's energy crisis to the refugee situation, but the focus repeatedly came back to him. Analysts say the EU is in no position to preach about rule of law in the light of its treatment of minority groups in the bloc, such as refugees. The problem has become worse due to recent developments in Afghanistan.
What this is doing is this is leading to a rise in xenophobia. These refugees, these people who, as I said, are at the lowest possible ebb, are now being subject to abuse and to hate crimes.
Inside the chamber, Morawiecki was criticised over his country's treatment of refugees, but he certainly was not without his supporters. Lawmakers want the European Commission to withhold billions of euro in funding to Poland, but that could be a lengthy process. When the Commission initiates proceedings against a member state, it normally takes many years before there is a conclusion to the case. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
The night in March 2021 that 33-year-old Sarah Everard was arrested, raped and murdered by police officer Wayne Curzons. He has been handed a life sentence, but since the murder, public trust in the force has plummeted. In 4 years, 2,000 officers have been accused of sexual misconduct, including rape. Nearly two-thirds of them have faced no further action. And a quarter of misconduct hearings are closed to the public. Britain's most senior police officer has promised a thorough investigation into the Met's culture, and the Independent Force for Police Conduct says it is dealing with a slew of new referrals since it changed the criteria for abuse of power for sexual purposes.
But is it about referral criteria or something more ingrained and sinister? Cousins was nicknamed the rapist by his colleagues, so why wasn't he weeded out earlier by the Met?
Climate change is sort of steroids for the weather. That's what experts say. From the northernmost to the southernmost points of the Earth, nowhere and no one is immune to this crisis. In India, people have been devastated by frequent heat waves.
We are affected a lot by this unbearable heat, and us poor are hit the hardest.
And so are Canadians.
It's just unbearable. It's impossible to be out.
This year, July was declared the world's hottest month ever recorded. A recent study shows if the world's emission of carbon dioxide and other greenhouse gases continues at the same level, in 30 years' time, there will be a climate change apocalypse. That means outdoor life in parts of the Middle East and North Africa would be impossible, regions that are already facing long periods of extreme heat.
We are very tired and cannot stand in the sun. Our situation is very bad. We are exhausted.
Researchers are now warning that even animals and plants are in danger. In a bid to survive, some countries are already looking for new ways to adapt to these intense situations. In Bangladesh, one of the countries worst affected by the extreme weather in recent decades, farmers are developing floating seed beds and salt-resistant rice to avoid unpredictable conditions.
This is the digital age. We saw on YouTube how greenhouse farming works. We tried it on a smaller scale, though. I am doing greenhouse farming this year on 8,000 square feet of land.
Estimates show that $5 trillion a year are needed by 2030 to find measures to fight global warming. But despite signs of progress in a few sectors, the majority of the tasks required for curbing the rising temperatures still seem to be far-fetched. And many are now saying that the upcoming United Nations conference, COP26, is the last major chance to galvanize a collective effort to fight climate change.
Unless there are immediate, rapid, and large-scale reductions in greenhouse gas emissions, we will be unable to limit global heating to 1.5 degrees Celsius, and the consequences will be catastrophic. COP26 this November must mark that turning point. By then, we need all countries to commit to achieve net zero emissions by the middle of this century and to present clear, credible, long-term strategies to get there.
All these are reminders that the fatal consequences of this human-induced crisis are threatening our planet now more than ever before.
Afghanistan has welcomed the recent remarks by leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, who called for greater unity between Sunnis and Shias. This according to a tweet by a spokesman of the political office of the Islamic Emirate of Afghanistan, Muhammad Naeem Wardak. He further said the Taliban are aware of the nation's enemies' scheme and work for tightening brotherhood among Afghan people.
The U.S. has always been trying to deepen the schism between Muslim sects both after the invasion and after the withdrawal. They don't stop their conspiracy, but the Islamic Emirate is aware of it and will never let the enemies of Islam reach their goals. However, they target Shias, but in fact they are against all of us.
Afghan people have also welcomed Iran's leaders' remarks. In a conference titled Islamic Unity Week and the Responsibility of People in the Afghan capital on Tuesday, the participants said Islamic unity should be part of culture in Muslim world.
Prominent Islamic scholar and the late founder of Iran's Islamic Republic, Ayatollah Khomeini, in a very critical point of time came and named this week as Islamic Unity Week, so that all Muslims keep their unity and brotherhood. We all have the same God, Prophet, and Qibla. Then let's benefit from these mutual values for our unity and make it a culture.
Addressing the 35th International Islamic Unity Conference in the Iranian capital, Iran's leader touched on the U.S. campaign to stoke sedition among Islamic countries with the help of its proxies. He said the recent unfortunate and distressing explosions at mosques targeting Muslim worshippers in Afghanistan are among such incidents that were carried out by Daesh. Earlier this month, Daesh terrorist group conducted two deadly attacks against Shia community in Afghanistan. Following the attacks, Muslim leaders noted that such incidents are meant to divide Muslims in the world.